Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Thanks to Canadian band Mr. Something Something from Toronto and the Afrobeat poet Ikwunga for our theme song, You Are Beautiful. My name is Jim Hutchings, and this week I'm joined by our co-host Mona Hill. Good afternoon, Mona.
Hi. Welcome back, everyone.
And our special guest today is Dr. Jim Harding. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Jim Harding is a retired professor of justice studies at the University of Regina. He's a founding member of the Regina Group for a Non-Nuclear Society. And did I say it wrong?
Yes.
Nuclear?
Thank you. I'm such a stickler.
Non-Nuclear Society. And let me start that again. He is a founding member of the Regina Group for a Non-Nuclear Society and was director of research for Prairie Justice Research at the University of Regina, where he headed up the Uranium Inquiries Project. Jim also acted as consultant to the NFB award-winning film Uranium. He's the author of Canada's Deadly Secret, Saskatchewan Uranium, and the Global Nuclear System.
Try again.
Nuclear system. Jim has a regular weekly column in Our Town News, papers that serve many towns in rural Saskatchewan. I've got to work on that.
I'm taking it away now, Jim.
Okay, you can take it, and I'll sit here and bleed.
Welcome back, everyone. It's great to be back on Human Rights Radio, and I'm so excited to have Jim Harding with us today. And this isn't the reason he's here today is in relation to an event that's occurring tonight, because we want to encourage everyone who can come out to do so. And I'm going to start off by reading something from Our Town News that I found online that Jim posted. I guess that's like a blog site, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why Colonial Mentality Can't Get Us to Sustainability. And this was written on February 25th. The nuclear industry is going around the North promoting a nuclear dump as if this was a way to bring development to an impoverished region. $1 million has already been provided by the NWMO, which would be...
the Nuclear Waste Management Organization, which is the industry that produces the waste.
Okay. To the FSIN, supposedly to help First Nations develop capacity for informed consent about a nuclear dump. Well, we're always looking for informed consent, aren't we?
Yep.
And now he poses a question. But why isn't $1 million available to look at sustainable economic options like more renewable energy in the North? The dice always seems to be loaded, and it is beginning to look like those driving the resource extraction agenda need the North to be impoverished so that there is less opposition when environmentally dangerous mega projects like a nuclear dump gets proposed. That's just the beginning
of it. It's sort of interesting to hear. Take it away. Read back.
Yeah.
Well, first, I want to make the human rights connection right off the bat.
Go for it.
Since Amnesty's sort of sponsoring this. The word sustainability, the reason I do this column on kind of moving Saskatchewan to a sustainable path is because that means intergenerational justice. That's really what sustainability means. It means we can't do things today in a way that undermine future generations, and I would say other species. For me, it's an ecological justice question as much. And we are doing pretty much everything. And today we'll talk about energy policy, obviously, in the waste stream with the nuclear system. But we're doing just about everything in a way that will make the future more difficult for people to meet their needs. And that is a human rights question.
Okay.
We've got to put human rights into that kind of a timeline where we think much like many land-based cultures, we're going to have to think more than seven generations ahead when we start thinking about nuclear waste, which I can talk about later on. So it is a rights issue right off the bat. Then, of course, you get into the question of First Nations rights and Aboriginal rights and treaty rights. And my goodness, here you have the industry negotiating directly with impoverished First Nations and Métis communities to try to convince them that this will provide them with short-term jobs to maybe keep some of their youth in the north, because there's a massive baby boom in Saskatchewan's
right.
north. And it's the only thing on the table. It's like saying to you, if you're in India or Africa, I know you're very, very poor. All we've got for you right now are the toxic boats from Europe, and you can dismantle them and basically get sick, but mm-hmm. at least you have an income. And, of mm-hmm. course, now the UN is trying to pass conventions against the movement of toxic waste, as they should. Well, that question is now on the Canadian agenda. Do we want toxic waste, 90% of which come from Ontario nuclear power plants, taken up to northern Saskatchewan communities because they're the second poorest region in Canada? Is that really a viable economic development strategy? Or is it a ploy? Or I would even say a bribe, in a sense, because you know if there's desperation and no options on the table, if it's this or nothing, people sometimes take what's offered. And, you know, I can quote AFM, the Assembly of First Nations. I'm not saying anything they're not saying. They're very worried about the monetary inducements, undermining informed consent. The UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, again, back to amnesty.
Right.
The Harper government played a game with us all. We had this massive coalition in support to try to get Canada to sign on, one of the few countries that hasn't. Harper said he was. The whole coalition dispersed, and I'm talking a big coalition, Kairos, which I'm active with, Amnesty was involved, mm-hmm. and then he didn't implement it. It was sort of like, well, not really, it's too difficult, so that we don't even have guidelines in international law on how mining's done in this country.
Yeah.
So these are all issues yeah. around the nuclear waste yeah. that we can
yeah.
talk about.
Yeah, exactly. And you're talking about, you know, First Nations, and I do have this that you posted on the Assembly of First Nations
mm-hmm.
and things
Looking
that they have
policies.
Said. One of the things I find interesting is that First Nations expressed concern that they had not had the time to study the proposals. The proposals did not incorporate traditional ecological knowledge. They strongly conflicted with their deeply held beliefs, and they doubted they would derive any significant benefit from agreeing to accept a nuclear waste facility in their territory. Mm-hmm. What I find interesting here is the concept of the proposals
mm-hmm.
and having a corporations or government suggesting, well, these are our proposals, but we've already made our decisions, so it's really a moot point. We're just showing you what we're going to do.
Now, human rights and democracy seem to kind of work together. And let's take a look at that. I have to be a historian to do this work, because the tactics around something like nuclear waste shift. It's sort of like they can't take no for an answer, and so if they get a no going in that direction, they'll change and go in another direction and hope you forget that
right.
something happened in the past. The longest sitting environmental review in Canadian history, it was called the Seaborne Inquiry, sat from 1991 to 1998. And what did it do? It went across Canada, talked to more Canadians than any other federal environmental review on whether Canadians supported deep geological centralized storage of nuclear waste. And guess what? They concluded we didn't. And their recommendations were such things as an arm's length body, which would start to really seriously tackle this question, how are we going to deal with the accumulating waste? What did the government do? It passed legislation giving the industry the right to look for a community to do deep geological storage. Completely the opposite of their own federal inquiry. Because the industry wanted to do that before the inquiry and never stopped. And the reason they want to do it, I'm not only a historian, I'm a literary critic, meaning I look at what they argue and see whether it makes sense in terms of what they say they're doing. They want centralized storage not because this has been proven to be a safe way to actually manage the nuclear waste stream, but because they want to have them all in one place so they can retrieve them to get the plutonium when they run out of uranium. Because they want the next generation of nuclear power to be viable.
That's my fear, that we're not just talking storage. We're talking about processing.
It's totally about processing. That's the only reason you want to take... Now, let's think about it. They pretend that they're part of the clean energy strategy, okay? Low carbon
and
all that.
What's clean energy supposed to mean from them?
But all that means is that nuclear power plants themselves don't emit carbon out of the stack the way a coal does. The trucks that mine, the trucks that move the yellow cake... The 18,000 truckloads of nuclear waste that is accumulated in Canada, 18,000 truckloads, I've calculated it using their figures, we'd have 18,000 trucks coming into northern Saskatchewan, which is 7 a day for 20 years, and that would just catch us up to what existing reactors have accumulated. If we became an international dump, and I can tell you if we create one, the U.S. has just canceled theirs at Yucca, after spending $13 billion on it because of geological and environmental issues. If we create one under the Fair Trade Agreement and NAFTA, there's every chance we'll be the waste stream for the continental energy system. Well, there's another 90,000 loads. Now, you heard my figure. So we're talking 108,000 truckloads. That is not clean. The traffic... hazards.
I'm getting a stomachache.
Well, but that's why we're fighting
it.
We have to stop it here. Every other jurisdiction's voting against it. We're the only ones left on the table, and we're fools. But everybody on those transportation routes, there's a psychic cost. The environmental impact is not just about toxicity. I want to talk about the toxicity because that's pretty amazing. It's about how people feel. Do they feel safe in their organic farmers, small settlements, people with their families? I talked to PA people. I said, do you want these trucks coming through here across the river? I went to LaRange. I said, think about it. You know what the mining trucks are doing to unsettle your sense of safety in the north. Now think about, you're sending yellow cake out. Now think about bringing plutonium back in. Tell me the north is going to feel safe as ecotourist, as a region. It'll change the whole field, whole perception of the north. There isn't going to be trapping and hunting and land-based economies.
Well,
it'll
who's going to want to risk eating anything off the land?
It would finish the north. The north would become the nuclear waste corridor for North America is what would happen. And I believe the industry has had a sort of strategy moving in that direction since the 90s, based on my studies. Cameco supported it. Bruce Power produces most of the waste. They're co-owned by Cameco. I mean, it's an interlocked corporate conglomerate, really. TransCanada builds transmissions lines. Bruce Power creates electricity, and uranium or Cameco provides the fuel, and they're one industry.
Mm-hmm.
So what are they doing right now with the waste that's being...
They're accumulating them on site at reactors and telling people there for three generations, don't worry, we're going to take them away, which psychologically and politically has worked.
Right.
Now they're behind the eight ball because they're running out of on-site storage room. In fact, some studies in the States show they're accumulating too many hot spent fuel rods for the safety requirements in the pools. They have cooling ponds. Because you can have radiological fires. You have there's safety issues right on site with storage nuclear waste. If you have a loss of cooling and the radiological, the heat that's in those spent fuels can actually burst into fire, you could burn off the metals and send off a plume of radiation. And many of these reactors are in high... densely populated areas. So our view in the coalition that I'm working with is they should really upgrade on-site storage right now, because we're playing with that safety while we're mucking around with this issue of, can we find a host community in the Cambrian Shield or in the pre-Cambrian Shield that will somehow take it?
And, of course, one of the things that's happening is that the government has taken, they've adopted a hands-off approach. They're letting the nuclear industry regulate itself.
That's right.
And when the agency that was supposed to be regulating the industry tried to do something with Chalk River, they fired the head of that particular agency.
Miss Keene.
Yeah. Linda Keene's gone.
And she was the first person. I've tracked the regulatory system for 40 years. When the ACL was making the CANDU plant as a crown corporation, the AACB was the regulatory. They were both on the same floor in the same office reporting to the same Minister of Energy. So enough of it became discredited enough through one botch after another that they created the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, supposedly having more arm's length. First time it asserted itself on one of the safety protocols, the government knocked her out of the picture, and they're back in bed with the nuclear waste management. And we've just seen it with Bruce Power's radioactive boilers being shipped to Sweden. Everyone along the St. Lawrence, every municipality opposed Bruce Power taking these radioactive boilers on the Great Lakes, because it breaches a lot of actual international agreements about moving waste. U.S. senators are opposed to it, not just the city of Toronto or the city of Montreal.
Right.
This is a serious issue going on in Ontario. And they're starting to realize that in these nuclear plants that they've been kind of naive and a bit blind about, there's huge toxic buildup of material, not just spent fuel. These boilers have plutonium in because of the way these reactors work. All the metals become radioactive because of the fission process. And so they're starting to realize right down there in Ontario and Quebec, they got a problem, which from my point of view is a good thing that they're waking up, so that they don't get into this, oh, no problem, out of sight, out of mind, we'll ship it to the, they say, remote area. That's code for Indian land.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, northern Saskatchewan is probably the most colonized part of the whole nuclear fuel system in Canada. I'd say northern Ontario is more aware of this because they battled this out actually in the 70s and the 80s, whereas we're just getting it for the first big whammo this time. And people have a lot to learn. They have to learn about what is this stuff? And what do you mean that you can put it down there and make it go away and then it's just the way it was before? Which actually an elder told me at Walson Lake, an industry person said, well, no, what you're doing is you're doing the right thing, because you brought it out and now you take it back and you cover it up and then you can get on with your life. And I thought, okay. So we do have to do some basic science education.
Well, speaking of basic science, you know, earlier you said taking yellow cake away. So what does that mean?
Well, that's your uranium oxide that they mill at the mine, and then they shoot it down to Ontario where it gets refined.
That's
to
a port,
either
port credit?
Well,
I think
Port Hope is where they've historically done most of the refining. Now in Port Hope, they build, they convert it to go into the U.S. reactors, which uses what's called an enriched uranium. And in their other plant in Ontario, they refine it to go into the CANDUs. It's a slightly different version of uranium. So there's a whole nuclear fuel system. So the yellow cake goes out, it gets turned into uranium fuel, it goes in the reactor, it's transformed into all these radioactive byproducts, like plutonium. And they last for, like, I can give you the figures, it's astonishing the kind of elements we create in this process of getting a bit of electricity, when we could, of course, produce electricity without fission, without water being used to deal with the waste, without mining that leaves toxic tailings, you know. And of course, this is essentially about moving to a sustainable energy system from a toxic one.
Okay, we have 5 minutes left, and I'm going to throw a little monkey wrench into the conversation. I've had a good friend for many years who was extremely upset and concerned about the anti-nuclear energy movement for the major reason that his father's cancer was cured through the use of the nuclear energy to, you know, cure cancer.
Right.
So this was very, very important to him. And I'm looking at this from another perspective, like I said, just so that we can look at different perspectives on this as to what would enable us to be able to cure cancer, for instance, if we didn't have, you know, I mean, I know you're not that kind of a doctor, but is there an alternative? Have there been have we had any alternatives offered to us for curing cancer, for instance, if we don't use nuclear energy?
You know, the sad thing is when they fired Keane as the head of the regulatory body, they all got onto the panic about what will happen to diagnosis and treatment of cancer patients.
Right.
And they got, and you know, in my opinion, that's the worst. The worst thing you should do is exploit people who are ill and desperate when all the science at the time showed, and our premier has just come on side, the press didn't say this. The $30 million they put into the U of S is not to make nuclear medical isotopes out of a fission process at all, because it's cheaper and you don't need fission. You don't need a nuclear reactor to create the isotopes.
Okay.
And that means you don't end up with a waste stream like plutonium.
Okay.
And they've been doing that all over the world. They've been doing it in Europe. The Americans have actually been calling for the shutdown of the reactors that create weapons-grade waste to create nuclear isotopes, like Chalk River. You realize Chalk River creates weapons-grade plutonium. And then you've got another problem. So we said that all through that debate. We said, red herring, you're exploiting the suffering of the poor. But the industry has exploited nuclear medicine from the very beginning. When you hear anybody here talk about Saskatchewan and the uranium industry, you hear about cobalt treatment, nuclear isotopes, and no one mentions that every speck of uranium from this province to the end of the 1960s went into nuclear weapons. Every speck. And that today, all the depleted uranium that's being used in anti-tank missiles, every one of those cruise and Tomahawk missiles that were in the shock and awe that hit Baghdad, alpha-emitting depleted uranium toxifying the land.
Okay.
And now the cancer, now you see, here's the link with cancer. The cancer rates among those kids in those areas is fivefold because of the depleted uranium.
Right.
And that actually comes out of the uranium's flow out of Saskatchewan, because I've tracked it to the states where. So we got it. Of course, we have to talk about nuclear medicine.
Yeah.
We have to talk about the whole.
Right.
The whole
exactly.
Thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm really glad that you were able to clarify that issue.
Yeah.
Are we ready for our break, Jim?
Well, we've got about a minute.
Okay. The one thing that I want, I'll just finish off with this, why colonial mentality can't get us to sustainability. The second half of this blog by Jim Harding. Neocolonial development follows a similar pattern everywhere. Impoverished regions provide a cheap labor pool for lucrative resource extraction. Corporations offer quote-unquote benefits to local people that end up benefiting the corporations. Colonial mentality comes hand in hand with this. Countries even break up over the deep contradictions. We just witnessed the resource-rich but impoverished South Sudan vote overwhelmingly for independence after a vicious civil war with the more politically and economically powerful North. And we're going to take a break now. We'll come back and talk with Dr. Jim Harding about nuclear waste, and about we will eventually get around to talking about what's happening tonight and how you can take part in understanding what's happening with the concept of dumping nuclear waste in northern Saskatchewan.
Right, and before we're done our show here, I've got to talk about the CJTR Look and Listen Lottery. So we'll do that after a break as well. So if I don't think of it, you'll remind me, won't you, Mona?
Yes, and I have some announcements to make, too.
Okay, we'll be right back.
Oh, where have you been, all blue-eyed, son? Where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart rain that's gonna fall. Oh, what did you see, my blue-eyed son? And what did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. I saw highway diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers bleeding. I saw a white ladder all covered with water. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's a heart, 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 rain's gonna fall. And what did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? I heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were blazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. I heard the sound of a clown who cried in the alley. I heard the sound of one person who cried he was human. And it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart rain. We're gonna fall. Who did you meet, my blue-eyed son? Yes, and who did you meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. I met a white man who walked a black dog. I met one woman whose body was burning. I met another girl, she gave me a rainbow. I met one man who was wounded in love. I met another man who was wounded in hatred. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard. And it's a hard rain that's gonna fall. Oh, what'll you do now, my blue-eyed son? And what'll you do now, my darling young one? I'm a-going back out for the rain starts a-falling. I'll to the depths of the deepest dark forest, where the people are many and the hands all empty, where the pellets of poison are flooding their waters, where the home in the valley meets the damp, dirty prison, and the executioner's face is always well hidden, where the hunger is ugly, where souls are forgotten, where black is the color and none is the number. And I'll tell it and show it and think it and breathe it, and reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking, but I'll know my song well before I start singing. And it's a heart, it's a heart. It's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard grave we're gonna fall.
And we're back.
Are we back?
Yes, we are.
Welcome back. This is Human Rights Radio on CJTR in Regina, and I'm Mona Hill, and I'm here with my co-host Jim Hutchings. Today we have a wonderful guest who agreed to come and visit with us, Dr. Jim Harding. And Dr. Harding has a blog site and a website that you might be interested in. Currently we're talking about the nuclear waste debacle, I might call it. The Saskatchewan government, the Canadian government, corporations are looking at dumping nuclear waste in northern Saskatchewan. So if you're interested in looking at more information about this, I'll give you some website addresses. First of all, you can go to cleangreensask.ca. That's cleangreensask is one word, .ca. Jim Harding's website is jimharding.brinkster.net. That's jimharding.brinkster.net. That's his website. And he also writes a blog, some pretty cool stuff in the blog. Crow's Nest Ecology, all one word, crowsnestecology.wordpress.com. And you'll be able to get a lot more information. He's got some really cool little booklets here. One of them is called What's the Alternative to Nuclear Colonialism in the North? I want to get into that a little bit more, too, the concept of colonialism and nuclear power and in the North. Another one is The Nuclear Way, a close look at Bruce Power's mega plan for Saskatchewan, and this goes back to a couple of years ago when they were trying to build a nuclear power plant here. The next one is Climate Change, Environmental Health, Nuclear Proliferation, and Saskatchewan's Energy Future. What's wrong with the UDP report? What's the UDP?
It was the Uranium Development Partnership set up by the Wall government to recommend how to add value to the uranium industry, and all of the members of the committee were in the uranium industry.
Right, okay.
So they were asked to tell us, to tell the government how they could expand.
Okay. By the way, you can get some of these booklets tonight. Let's just maybe mention that in Regina at the Cathedral Neighborhood Center, starting at 6 o'clock, there's going to be a potluck dinner. Bring your own plate, bring your own cutlery, and I think we should bring our own mugs, maybe.
And food.
Mugs. Oh yeah, we have to bring food too.
You know,
I'll just
food,
show up with all my
to
cutlery.
Put on the plate.
There's
something
no food. The bring plate. Some food along with you. We're all going to share the potluck.
We'll eat together, and then we'll
yes. And what better way to develop really great relationships besides mm-hmm. eating together, right? Mm-hmm. And Jim's going to talk about all of this. He's going to talk about the issue of the nuclear waste, government responses, and what it means to First Nation people. Jim is not just off the top of his head. He has had consultation with First Nation people up north, and he's traveled around the province, and he's done consultation and asked them their feelings about this sort of thing. So you can hear all this tonight. You might get some other perspectives, too. I'm suspecting you may get some perspectives about what's going on in Europe and what's been going on, how we can learn from some of the European countries, too.
Well, and at the community forums, I'll explain what this is part of. there is a coalition for Clean Green Saskatchewan. It brought together 25 groups around the Bruce Power proposal around building nuclear plants in the North Saskatchewan. I've been trying to help bridge the gap between the secular environmental groups and the ecumenical environmental groups. The ecumenical groups like Kairos, which is in the news because of Harper's, you know, game, basically altering documents. Another issue, except Kairos has been very active on water, energy, carbon reduction campaigns. And I work with the Fort Capel Kairos. I'm active with that group. We brought together a whole number of groups because you can't run a campaign like this when you don't have the budget of industry unless it's run as a, as an NGO coalition, which means everybody brings their resources to it. We had no budget. We had no staff. But we were able to mobilize thousands of people across the province to go to those hearings and express these views that we want to make the shift away. We don't want to go into nuclear from the frying pan into the fire. We want to phase out coal and start moving to conservation and non-nuclear options and the renewables, which Saskatchewan is ripe for. Other jurisdictions have already hit 20-25% wind. We've got 4% of our grid.
I think that would be out near Swift Current, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And I'm putting wind in on our farm, and there's potential for decentralized wind production and income for farmers, for First Nations. Villages should be. The Europeans are doing this.
We have an office right next door to a radio station up here in the, on the building, and they are involved in a wind turbine.
Good.
You know.
Good. So, I mean, we've got to change the policy. SaskPower's got some people in there supportive, but the political masters haven't yet moved SaskPower to be responsive. So we created that coalition. We're rebuilding it now around the nuclear waste campaign.
Right.
Our objective is a legislative ban in Saskatchewan on importing, transporting, or storage of high-level nuclear waste from reactors. Now, isn't it interesting? Our neighborhood province, Manitoba, passed a ban in 1987, and most people in Saskatchewan don't even know that Manitoba said no to nuclear waste.
I remember
in 1987.
I was there.
Because they tried the same thing. They went into the Lac de Bonnie area out of Winnipeg. They started doing drilling. The local community found out. There were reports leaked that showed the retrievability of waste for the potential reprocessing. There were reports showing that they were actually finding that the radionuclide test isotopes that they were doing experiments on watersheds. Mm. Stuff was moving. Of course, water moves, like duh.
Yeah.
And especially when you crack up the rock and dig caverns, you know, you alter the underground geology and hydrology. So the province passed a ban. Quebec, 2 years ago, passed a legislative ban that doesn't allow importing nuclear waste. They've got their own at their two reactors, and they should be responsible for them. But they've said, no way Ontario's bringing them in. And the Premier of New Brunswick just last week said, there's no way that nuclear waste are coming to New Brunswick. Excuse me, who's left? Us. And the question is, why isn't our premier saying no nuclear waste in Saskatchewan? Ontario has to deal with their own waste stream. Now, I don't think Ontario should dump them in the north. I think there's another way to approach this.
What do you think is another way to approach
it? Well, I think if you don't have after 50, 60 years any kind of reasonable way to manage this waste stream, and the toxicity is actually going to increase after 100,000 years. These wastes actually become more radioactive after 100,000 years. I can explain that how that happens in terms of how radiation decays and turns into other elements.
So maybe that's the problem, Jim. Maybe people are looking at this going 100,000 years. We can't even fathom the Earth being around in 100,000 years. So what's the issue?
And the question is, should we continue to accumulate waste that we don't know what to do with and potentially threaten the future? So we're all taking the position of phase out this toxic industry and reduce the waste burden right now. Stop pretending you're going to find some hole in the ground and justify yourself going on creating more of the waste. And that position seems to be gaining ground in Ontario. The movement there to phase out nuclear power is growing, and they've actually got some fairly good policies for phasing in the renewables in Ontario. They've actually got better policies than we do, but they still produce 40% of their electricity with these nuclear plants. Mm-hmm. Germany's phasing them out. China, although they have a couple they're building, if you take a look at their renewable strategy, it's like tenfold what their nuclear is. Wouldn't that be interesting?
Wow.
If China ended up moving to renewables faster than the West.
Right.
Globally, renewables passed nuclear for all energy globally. Renewables passed nuclear in 2005. Nuclear's dropped from 18% of global electrical production to 13%. Surprise, surprise. It's costly as hell, just market factors, let alone this, the hidden costs, the waste, because they don't usually cost that into the electrical bill. It's a cost.
You know, one thing that a lot of people don't realize, that they sort of bill themselves as being reliable.
Yeah.
But if you live anywhere near a reactor, or... like in at the Bruce, they've got a number of reactors there.
Yeah.
They're never all producing at the same time. There's always something
wrong
with...
The studies that I've got in my book, I went back and I actually looked at it. They always claim that they'll work at about a 90-some percent. Mm-hmm. They actually worked at about 60% when you actually looked at the track record.
And Pickering took a long time to... I don't think they're working properly
their
yet.
Well, their refurbishing costs are in the billions, and they're having to refurbish these reactors 10, 15 years before they said they would.
Yep.
So their projections on the decay of the quality of the metals were wrong. Right now, as we speak, guess what Japan's doing? Right this minute, because of the earthquake. They're shutting down reactors.
Right, they just had an earthquake.
They're shutting down reactors right now.
Yeah.
Because they have to, because they don't know whether they're going to get... They built their reactors in Japan on a fault in the mountains.
Okay.
And they've just had the strongest earthquake in recorded history, an 8.9. Now, they can get bigger.
Yeah.
Let me tell you,
geology
is not a predictive science. It's just another reason I oppose centralizing everything in the Canadian Shield in one place. I don't care if that's been stable, quote-unquote stable, for a billion years. That's not the way the Earth works. We can't predict very well the way geology is unfolding, and I think we're going to have to probably think about how we build settlements and the standards of buildings, like look at the Haitian catastrophe.
Yeah.
That's building standards largely in poverty.
Yeah. And the industry is always talking about how, a new technology, new generation. And Canada tried to develop a new reactor, the Maple reactor, and they haven't got it running yet.
And they spent $450 million
on
it.
So it's just going to be a huge white elephant.
So
$2 billion of subsidies from Harper since he formed the minority government to the nuclear industry, which hasn't led to one speck of new energy.
How much was that?
$2 billion.
$2 billion.
If that $2 billion had been diverted to ramp up the renewables, there's people ready to go in Saskatchewan and all over the country. There's small businesses. If that $2 billion had been moved to renewables, we could probably have made our Kyoto targets.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have a political problem and an economic problem. We don't have a technological problem. The alternative technology is up and ready to go. But
let's go back to waste.
Yep.
Just the simplest question. What is nuclear waste? What's the composition of it?
Okay, so you have these fuel bundles you put in a reactor, and they get bombarded to split the uranium atoms, which creates magnificent heat, which boils water, which turns a turbine, which creates electricity. It's the stupidest way to boil water. You know, essentially a dam... it uses the flow of the river to turn the turbine. A coal plant, of course, does the same thing, except it doesn't create the waste stream. Coal's a problem, obviously, around climate change. After that uranium fuel is bombarded, it ends up becoming 200 toxic chemicals. And they have massive longevity. Plutonium, for example, half-life 26,000 years. That means multiply that by 20 times. Okay.
Don't do math.
Well, you have to multiply. So you end up with many hundreds of thousands of years of toxicity from plutonium. And now you've got this much more toxic bioavailable set of chemicals. Cesium, iodine, carbon, all these are radioactive, which means they can initially send out powerful gamma radiation, which can be disruptive to the biological cell. Later on, they can become alpha radiation, and that's the kind of stuff you don't want to breathe and get in your lungs, like radon gas, which we find
in our homes.
Radon gas, second cause of cancer, lung cancer globally after smoking.
This really?
Yeah. It's not something you want. It's at every uranium mine. It's in all uranium tailings, okay? And it ultimately will come from the radium that will come from the byproducts of nuclear waste. So you're basically creating a soup of toxic, long-lived radioactive elements. And they decay. First 500 or 600 years, it's mostly gamma. Then the next 100,000, it becomes another kind of radiation, mostly alpha. The mathematical models they've done say, well, it looks like it'll start deteriorating it's starting to build again. After 100,000 years, it starts to go back up. Because everything's breaking down into another element. Uranium becomes lead in 2.5 billion years. Okay. Think about that.
Okay.
And lead's still a heavy metal and a toxin.
Yeah.
Uranium is an element to be respected. Because it's big, it's heavy, it's unstable. For it to stabilize, so we've somehow said we're being really clever, we're going to go in there and break it up and get some heat from the fission, splitting the atom, and as Mr. Einstein said, everything's changed in the nuclear age, but our way of thinking.
Interesting. Let's go back to First Nations.
So this stuff is to be respected.
Yeah.
It's dangerous. It's not the kind of stuff you want to accumulate.
Right. Okay, we got 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I want to just briefly touch on the First Nation groups of people that are living in the North who currently don't have sustainable employment mm-hmm. on the reserves, on their land, mm-hmm. And they're being offered an opportunity to work with the mm-hmm. government and work with the nuclear energy companies to bury this on their land and maybe mm-hmm. give jobs to their people.
Mm-hmm.
I understand there's a few people who are maybe considering it. Let's talk about that.
Well, right off the bat, the duty to consult, which all First Nation, all Indigenous groups say there should be duty to consult, and real informed consent. In international law, it's free, prior informed consent.
Yes.
It's not monetary inducements. $450,000 to Métis Nation, never been publicized, but they've got it. $1 million to FSIN. I asked them, where's that going? And apparently, only $100,000 is actually going to Patranac, which is the community that says, well, we'll consider it. And it's only being used to provide industry-based resources. The vice chief of the FSIN said that when they accepted the $1 million. How can you create informed consent when the industry gives you money to only get their view, which doesn't include talking about the nature of the waste, by the way?
Oh, really?
No. I'll tell you some of the half-truths, but I'll save some for tonight.
Yeah.
The industry says, well, the toxic waste will be back to background level in 600 years. No. That's gamma radiation. The alpha radiation actually gets bigger, and then in 100,000 years, it's actually even bigger than when you put it under the ground. So I won't say they're lying. I'd say those are called half-truths,
right.
Carefully selected half-truths. So you want informed consent, get some independent scientists. Some independent geologists, not the ones who work for the industry. So they're not going to get a fully balanced view through industry resources. We're doing these community forums because it's all we've got to try to provide other information. And we've had one in LaRonge, and we'll try to get people to Pine House and English River. And
And we're going to do another community forum tonight at the Cathedral Village Neighborhood Center on 13th Avenue in Regina. Come on out. We're having a potluck. Bring some food. Bring your own cutlery and plate and a cup. And we'll listen to Jim and get more information on this. Do we have time for these announcements, Jim?
I'd like to do mine first.
Okay, go.
It's the CJTR Look and Listen Lottery, and you can win a complete audio-video makeover for your home. The grand prize is a 58-inch Panasonic 3D plasma TV with a home theater receiver, 3D Blu-ray player, complete surround sound speaker package, theater seating for three, stands for the TV and speakers, and installation in your home for a retail value of $10,040. Second prize is a 50-inch Panasonic plasma TV, retail value $1,100. Third prize, Monster Beats by Dr. Dre, iPod Doc Boombox, retail value $550. Whew, lots of good stuff here. The draw date is Friday, June 17th, 5 p.m. Tickets are just $20 each, and only 1,000 tickets will be sold. So, you can look for complete rules and prize details at www.cjtr.ca. Prizes are furnished by Radio Center Consumer Electronics. And CJTR 2011 Spring Raffle license number is number RR100098. And give us a call here and we'll get you some tickets. Okay.
Okay.
So that gives you about a minute and a half.
Okay, good. You did good. Amnesty International, you're invited to our Regina Community Group AGM on Friday, March 18th at the CNIB office at 2550 Broad Street. That's March 18th at 7 o'clock. This is the Amnesty Regina Group AGM. Guest speaker will be Darlene Yushka, Associate Professor of Gender and Women's Studies from the U of R. We are looking for people who would love to work with our community group for new board members, some new ideas, and come on out and see what we're all about. You don't have to feel that you have to join the board, but we'd sure like to have you show up and hear from you. Number two is the Amnesty International University of Regina Campus Club State Night Fundraiser. We have a wonderful campus club this year of extremely active, brilliant young people that are trying to raise some funds. So Sunday, March 13th at between 4 and 9 p.m. at the Hub Sports Bar, $20. For tickets, call Aurora at 551-5650. And that's about it.
Okay, as we close this week's Human Rights Radio and CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people.
And nuclear energy from Jim Harding.
For info on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to cjtr.ca. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said it's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness.
Thanks for being with us.